Alien, let's go here.
All right, that was a hard act to follow.
Really?
Okay, the title of my talk is Does Reason Govern the World, or Does the World Govern Reason, for the left? My talk concerns Hegel's philosophy of history and its legacy for the left. Before starting, I should point out that Hegel has influenced both the left and the right, and the legacy of his philosophy of history is no exception. My talk, however, will be solely on his legacy on the enterprise of the left, and more specifically, that part of the left influenced by Marx. The basic idea of Hegel's philosophy of history can be found in a short volume that has been translated and republished several times with the title Introduction to the Philosophy of History, or sometimes just Reason and History. What this still slim volume represents are Hegel's own introduction to his lectures on the philosophy of history. And it is here that Hegel systematically explains what he is doing in terms of how his presentation of history is a philosophical project and how it fits into his overall understanding of the development of philosophy. Hegel makes clear his position at the very start of his discussion when he says, "The only thought which philosophy brings with it in regards to history is the simple thought of reason, the thought that reason governs the world, and that world history has therefore been rational in its course." He goes on to say, "This conviction and insight is a presupposition in regards to history as such, although it is not a presupposition in regards to philosophy." When Hegel says that reason governs the world, what he is saying is that human history has an inner logic, and that inner logic asserts itself in the long run, although it does so in a contradictory manner. At any one moment and in the lives of any specific person, not only is there no recognizable rationality, but in fact, things appear to be quite irrational. He even calls history at one point a slaughter bench. Hegel's point in saying that reason governs the world is not to assert a eudaimonic cosmos where good always triumphs against evil. He denies, in fact, this naive view quite explicitly. He says, "World history is not the place for happiness. Periods of happiness are empty pages in history, for they are the periods of harmony, times when the antithesis is missing. Nor is the epigram, reason governs the world, meant to describe a world in which every event has a meaning that can only be divined through the mysterious working of a divine providence." Hegel clearly recognized that history is composed of many events that are quite horrible and have no saving grace or touch of reason. What then did Hegel mean by that statement? It is the belief that the goal of history is freedom, and that freedom is actualized in history and that it will ultimately triumph. Note that this does not mean that Hegel thinks there is no such thing as evil in the world, or that it is possible for a world to exist without any evil, only that the trajectory of history leads to the expansion of freedom, and that freedom will be the dominant force in the modern world. A phenomenon that Hegel had thought had already been achieved in his time. But this leads to another question. What exactly does Hegel mean by freedom? It's a question not without controversy among Hegel scholars. Some think that freedom is the ability to make decisions that are truly self-determined. Others see freedom as self-actualization in the sense of a neo-Aristotelian vision of the good life. Still others see it as a form of reconciliation with the other. I think there are aspects of all these meanings in Hegel's understanding of freedom, but I also find them deficient because none of them explain how freedom can overcome evil. And the introduction of evil brings us back to Hegel's remark in his introduction that the philosophy of history can be considered as a kind of theodicy. Following Leibniz, he maintains that the task of philosophy is really the same as a theodicy, literally to explain the ways of God to man. This is a quote. "In our knowledge, we aim for the insight that whatever was intended by the eternal wisdom has come to fulfillment, as in the realm of nature, so in the realm of spirit that is active and actual in the world. To that extent, our approach is a theodicy, a justification of the ways of God. Leibniz attempted a theodicy in metaphysical terms, using indefinite abstract categories, so that when once the evil in the world was comprehended in this way, the thinking mind was supposed to be reconciled to it. Nowhere, in fact, is there a greater challenge to such intellectual reconciliations than in world history. This reconciliation can be achieved only through the recognition of that positive aspect in which the negative disappears as something subordinate and overcome. It is attained on the one hand through the awareness that this end goal has been actualized in the world and that evil has not prevailed in it in any ultimate sense. It is important to understand the metaphorical functions of the words God and theodicy in order to make sense of this passage. Hegel completely rejected the transcendent God of traditional Christianity. For him, God is immanent in the world of spirit, the work that is of man. So it is a notion of God that turns Christianity, and for that matter, all traditional religion on its head. Now, traditionally, a theodicy tries to reconcile the existence of God, who is conceived as all good and powerful, with the existence of evil in the world. For the pious, it is important to explain that a beneficent God exists who is all-powerful, but that events like the Holocaust can still be reconciled to the existence of this all-powerful and benevolent God. For Hegel, a theodicy is somewhat different. There is no all-powerful God. What there is the continual work of spirit actualizing freedom, creating a culture that is more and more conscious of itself and its works. What he is saying in his secularized theodicy is that we overcome evil through the labor of spirit, and this includes reconciling ourselves to the continued existence of evil as an unavoidable part of the human condition, though one that can be ameliorated and which no longer in our modern age dominates or defines us. There is at once an optimism in this view, one that reflects the influence of the Enlightenment and the French Revolution, and also a realism that no matter what progress we make, certain evils like death or natural catastrophes are inevitable. In considering the question of the continued existence of evil in the world, it remains open as to exactly what can be overcome, both for individuals and for society as a whole. There is only the certainty that it can be overcome. Hegel would never have accepted the pessimistic proposition that there is nothing we as a society can do to avoid a repetition of the Holocaust, although he probably would not have been very optimistic that there is much that philosophers can contribute to that. And while natural catastrophes such as earthquakes are inevitable, there is nothing inevitable in the human toll they take. That is something that it is possible to ameliorate, if not avoid entirely. Misreadings of Hegel begin with failing to understand his religious metaphors. To be sure, Hegel himself contributed to this misreading. He did so in a way that he could not have anticipated, because for him it was entirely natural to couch his philosophical insights in terms of metaphors taken from the world of theology. This was a natural step for Hegel because, in fact, he began his intellectual life as a seminary student, but at a certain point realized that philosophy was his life's work and looked upon religion as a kind of popular idiom that expresses the content of philosophy when properly understood, although it expresses that content imperfectly. It was also natural in another sense. Hegel was trying to speak not merely to an academic elite, but to ordinary people. And in speaking to ordinary people, particularly the students that came to his classroom, he could not presume any deep understanding of philosophy. So he tried to speak to them in a language they understood, that of religion, which he saw as expressing the same content as philosophy, though doing so in a non-reflective manner. But in more recent years, when people who have been conditioned by a secular culture first come upon Hegel, they fail to notice the metaphorical use of his language and take his statements at face value. This has led to and continues to lead to numerous misreadings of Hegel. There's numerous misreadings in the academic literature. I'm not going to deal with that in this paper. The interpretation of Hegel that I specifically want to deal with here derives from the tradition of Orthodox Marxism. What I wish to examine is the identification of Hegel's philosophy of history with a specific theory of the nature of historical law. This interpretation was articulated most thoroughly and systematically by the Russian Marxist Georgi Plekhanov. Plekhanov wrote about this topic in a number of essays, but its most complete statement can be found in a long appreciation he wrote about Hegel titled For the 60th Anniversary of Hegel's Death. Plekhanov, who clearly was very fond of Hegel, tries to summarize what he considers of lasting value in Hegel to the modern socialist movement, while at the same time pointing out that which, in his eyes, marks Hegel as a thinker from another era. In doing so, he examines Hegel's statement that reason governs the world. And this is Plekhanov. When Hegel repeated with Anaxagoras that reason governs the world, on his lips, that did not at all mean that the world is governed by the thought of man. Of course, that's true, but the problem comes when Plekhanov explains exactly what Hegel did mean. And this is where Plekhanov invokes what Hegel called the cunning of reason. Quoting Hegel, he writes, In world history, man's actions result in something quite different from what he purposes or intends. He fulfills his own interests, but thereby something more is brought into being, which is admittedly contained therein, but was not in his consciousness or his intentions. States, peoples, and individuals pursue their private interests, their particular aims. From this standpoint, they are undeniably conscious thinking agents. But consciously pursuing their own private aims, which generally are also permeated with definite universal aspirations to what is good and right, they unconsciously accomplish the aims of the universal spirit. Actually, the last part is a quote from Hegel. We cannot fault Plekhanov for introducing the kind of reason. All this really isn't Hegel. But in Plekhanov, it has a very different significance. He sees Hegel as describing conscious human decision-making in pursuit of one interest as a means to an end, the end being the work of spirit. In this sense, people are dehumanized while a spirit that stands over them becomes an agency in its own right, one that only uses people to accomplish its ends. This is the gist of the example Plekhanov cites to illustrate his point, the example of Julius Caesar. This is a quote from Plekhanov. Caesar aimed at autocracy in Rome. That was his personal aim. But autocracy was at the same time a historical necessity. Hence, in accomplishing his personal aim, Caesar served the universal spirit. In this sense, we can say that historical figures and also whole peoples are blind instruments of the spirit. It forces them to work for it by holding out to them the bait of their private aims and urging them on with the spur of passion, without which nothing great is done in history. Now, the image of whole peoples as blind instruments of reason, note that image. Hegel never said anything like that. In fact, Hegel warns his students against such a reading. Right after introducing his discussion of the cunning of reason, Hegel says, some might find it acceptable to see individuals sacrificed along with their aims and fulfillments, consigning their happiness to the realm of chance to which it belongs, or even to regard individuals altogether under the category of means to an end. Yet there is that aspect of theirs which we must refuse to see in this light, even for the sake of the higher goal, simply because there is that in individuals which is not to be made subordinate, but is something intrinsically eternal and divine. He goes on to say that although in one sense the conscious desires and interests of individuals are merely means to an end, they are not for that matter unimportant and easily dismissed, but have an infinite right to be satisfied. His point is that there cannot be an unbridgeable gap between means and ends. He says, in speaking of a means, we at first imagine something merely external to the end and having no part in it. But in actuality, even natural things in general, even the most common lifeless objects used as means must already be such as to be appropriate to their end and must have something in common with it. Humans do not see themselves as the means for the goals of reason in that entirely external sense at all. On the contrary, not only do they use the occasion to satisfy their particular interest, whose content is different from that goal, but they also have a part in that rational goal itself. For that very reason, they are to be regarded as ends in themselves. We see then that Plekhanov's image of the interests of individuals and whole peoples as blind instruments of the spirit is a flattening out of Hegel. It takes human desires and interests as means to an end, while dropping Hegel's insistence that these interests and desires contribute to the ultimate goal, and that humans are therefore not only means, but ends in themselves. But it is here in this flattened version of Hegel's cunning of reason that Plekhanov locates what he considers to be the touchstone of Hegel's contribution to the world outlook of Marxism. Plekhanov writes, "The accident of human arbitrariness and human prudence gives place to conformity to laws, that is, consequently, to necessity. In this lies the unquestionable superiority of absolute idealism compared with the naive idealism of the French thinkers of the Enlightenment. Absolute idealism, seeking the explanation of the movement of history in something which is independent of human arbitrariness, sets science the task of explaining the phenomena of history in conformity to laws, and in fulfillment of this task does away with any necessity for the hypothesis of the spirit, which was quite worthless as far as this explanation was concerned." But what, that's the end of the quote, "but what happens to the notion of freedom if all we are left with is that reason governs the world means no more than that individual decisions and actions are in conformity to laws that work independently of the people making them, and that we are all somehow blind actors in a play written by an external agency using us to achieve its ultimate ends." And here we can consider freedom in all the senses in which we discussed it already, as the ability to make decisions that are self-determined, or self-actualization of one's potential, or reconciliation with another, and finally the overcoming of evil in the world. Plekhanov's response is that we must embrace necessity. And citing Schelling, he tells us that while the Enlightenment could go no farther than the abstract opposition between freedom and necessity, quote, "the correct view of the matter is that freedom is necessity, necessity is freedom." He ends his discussion of Hegel's history of philosophy by noting it was Hegel who finally, quote, "saw the antinomy between freedom and necessity. He proved that we are truly free only insofar as we know the laws of nature and socio-historical development, and insofar as we, submitting to them, rely upon them." This was a tremendous gain in the field of philosophy and also in that of social science, a gain which, however, only modern dialectical materialism exploited to the full. Just as a side note, I think that was the first use of the term dialectical materialism in history, in that quote. I have been quoting at length from Plekhanov in order to let him present his views. Now let us see what the implications of Plekhanov's appropriation of Hegel meant. I have already alluded to the flattening of Hegel's guiding thread in the philosophy of history, namely that reason governs the world. Alongside this, we can see a flattening of the idea of freedom. We may grant, following Plekhanov, that freedom is something of an illusion if we are ignorant of the laws governing natural and social phenomena. But is that all there is? And how do we understand the laws governing social phenomena? Plekhanov sees the social realm as analogous to the natural realm, and just as Newton discovered the laws of gravity and thereby explained the movement of the Earth and the planets as being in conformity to universal laws, so he considers Marx to have achieved the corresponding laws in the social realm. And according to Plekhanov, a good scientist must submit to these laws and rely on them. Now, it is hardly possible not to submit to the laws of gravity, and we certainly rely on it to continue walking on our feet instead of walking on our head. And if we understood the way gravity works, I suppose our lives would be easier because we would avoid all the angst of Peter Pan, who thought he could fly if he just wished it. But do the laws of socio-historical development work like that? To be sure, there is a grain of truth in Plekhanov's statements. It would be foolish to think you can escape the domination of the market over our lives by simply deciding that you will opt out of it. Thereby hangs many a tale of failed workers' cooperatives and communes that were guided by the illusion that a tiny enclave of socialism can be established within capitalist society. And it is also true that a project whose goal is that of human liberation can hardly succeed if it is ignorant of the laws of capitalism. But on the other hand, it is difficult to see how such a project can get anywhere if we are required to submit to those laws. Or in other words, taking Plekhanov's view of the cunning of reason to its logical conclusion, in what way can our being blind actors, in this case not of the spirit but of the laws of the capitalist market, advance us toward the final goal of communist society? Were one to take that proposition seriously, one would have to say that human liberation is an unconscious process that takes place automatically behind the backs of men, whether they like it or not. Such a notion conceives of historical laws in a purely mechanical way, not as working through the conscious decisions of individuals, but as working out a logic of its own despite the decisions of individuals. What Plekhanov's reading of Hegel reflects is the growing influence of positivism in philosophy and the social sciences in the latter half of the 19th century. This was a topic that was covered in Herbert Marcuse's classic work in the 1930s, Reason and Revolution. In that work, Marcuse summed up the difference between Hegel's philosophy and the turn toward positivism that came later and that attempted to dethrone Hegel. Marcuse called Hegel a philosophy of a negative philosophy, because the implication of the Hegelian dialectic is that the reality of our current existence must give way to the march of reason, thereby negating it. In the philosophy of history, this meant, to quote Marcuse, social and political reality cannot, for any length of time, conform to the demands of reason, for the state seeks to maintain the interests of that which is, and thus to fetter the forces that tend to a higher historical form. Sooner or later, the free rationality of thought must come into conflict with the rationalizations of the given order of life. This was the subversive side of the dialectic, and recognizing its revolutionary implications, conservative forces throughout Europe launched a counterattack shortly after Hegel's death, beginning with the attack on Hegel's negative philosophy by his former friend and colleague, Schelling. The positive philosophy that emerged in the 1840s and its later evolution into positive social science was an attempt to put the genie back in the bottle that Hegel's dialectic had released. In the words of Marcuse, positive philosophy was to overcome negative philosophy in its entirety, that is, to abolish any subordinating of reality to transcendental reason. Moreover, it was to teach men to view and study phenomena of their world as neutral observers governed by universally valid laws. This tendency became particularly important in social and political philosophy. Hegel had considered society and the state to be the historical work of man, and therefore interpreted them under the aspect of freedom. In contrast, the positive philosophy studied the social realities after the pattern of nature and under the aspect of objective necessity. The independence of matters of fact was to be preserved, and reasoning was to be directed to an acceptance of the given. In this way, positive philosophy aimed to counteract the critical process involved in the philosophical negating of the given and to restore to facts the dignity of the positive. Returning now to our consideration of Plekhanov, it is clear that he interprets Hegel, or at least that part of Hegel which he thinks can be rescued for the modern socialist movement, as a positive philosopher. Plekhanov therefore turns Hegel on his head, but hardly in the way that he imagined he had. Plekhanov's motivation, it should be acknowledged, was very different from the conservatives. Plekhanov was defending Marxism and its insistence on the law-governed nature of historical processes. He was doing that against other socialists in his period that discounted any kind of deliberation in historical law. But in searching out for a philosophical grounding in Hegel for his polemics against the Russian populace, Plekhanov adopted a conservative method that eviscerated the subversive side of Hegel's philosophy of history. Plekhanov, it should be noted, was not alone in this respect. The influence of positivism was so profound in the latter part of the 19th century and the early 20th century that it had been widely, if unconsciously, adopted by most of the leading spokesmen for Marxism. In this respect, we can cite Karl Kautsky, the leading theoretician of the Second International, as well as Rudolf Hilferding as chief economic theorist. I should add that there was a minority current within Marxism that did not sit well with these positivist interpretations of Marxism. These consisted of primarily of Marxists from Italy and some of the Central European countries who had a greater affinity for Hegel than did the German and Russian Marxists. Among these was the great Italian Marxist Labriola. But they were mostly a voice in the wilderness, and the story I am relating is not their story, but that of the dominant figures of Marxism in this period. And what were the political and practical implications of reading Marxism as a form of positive social science? This was transmitted into the belief that the laws of history are on our side, and as long as we follow them, socialism is inevitable. Hegel's dictating that reason governs the world was converted by his followers of Marx into the dictum that the laws of capitalist production rule the world, and they will spontaneously lead to socialism. And for a while, this optimistic viewpoint seemed justified. The socialist movement from the 1870s to the eve of World War I got stronger and more influential. That is, until the carnage of the First World War showed that war and mass slaughter is also a possible outcome of the spontaneous working out of capitalist production relations. Since I've been told we are running out of time, I am going to skip to
yes.
the end.
Yes.
So you will unfortunately miss some other material.
Well, you should post that. It's a very good essay.
I will post it. So I will just skip to my what I said about Marx as opposed to the tradition of Orthodox Marxism.
Yeah, let's hear that. Yeah.
Okay.
How many pages is it?
Yeah, we need to hear that.
If I could fit that all in 12 minutes.
We need to leave some time.
Having said something about the appropriation of Hegel's philosophy of history by Orthodox Marxism, I wanted to say a few words about Marx. Of course, Marx did say a number of things about history, but most famously his account of the materialist conception of history in the German ideology. But Marx most certainly did not see anything progressive in submitting to the laws of history that work their way independently of our decisions. Marx's attitude toward history was that so long as history entailed individuals who serve as agents for historical laws that work outside of and independent of their conscious activity, we are living in an alienated existence. Marx called this the prehistory of man. The real history of man only begins when humanity is no longer subject to laws created external to us, but when we create our own history as conscious subjects. You might say that the historical project for Marx is the overcoming of historical law, which would end the history of man's prehistory and begin the age of his real history. I will present one quote from Marx to illustrate his kinship with Hegel's notion of freedom and its relation to the overcoming of historical law. The quote is taken not from his early work, but from Volume 3 of Capital. In fact, in the realm of freedom, actually begins only where labor, which is determined by necessity and mundane consideration, ceases. Thus, in the very nature of things, it lies beyond the sphere of actual material production. Just as the savage must wrestle with nature to satisfy his wants, to maintain and reproduce life, so must civilized man, and he must do so in all social formations and under all possible modes of production. With his development, this realm of physical necessity expands as a result of his wants, but at the same time, the forces of production which satisfy these wants also increase. Freedom in this field can only consist in socialized man, the associated producers, rationally regulating their interchange with nature, bringing it under their common control instead of being ruled by it as by the blind forces of nature, and achieving this with the least expenditure of energy and under conditions most favorable to and worthy of their human nature. But it nonetheless still remains a realm of necessity. Beyond it begins the development of human energy, which is an end in itself, the true realm of freedom, which, however, can blossom forth only with this realm of necessity as its base. The shortening of the working day is its basic prerequisite. Thus, while doing more than anyone else to bring to light of day the actual laws of motion of capitalism, Marx's goal was the overcoming of those very laws through the establishment of a communist society in which man's relationship with the products of his labor and with his fellow man and nature also is conscious and transparent. This nicely corresponds to Hegel's notion of history ending with the actualization of freedom in the world. So I have said something about the historical legacy of Orthodox Marxism, and I tried to make the point that it's a bad legacy, but it's not the fault of Hegel or of Marx. It's a result of the misappropriation of Hegel, specifically of his philosophy of history, for what was thought to be the project of Marx. That's my end.
All right, we have 10 minutes.